Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
My father, Seamus, and I both grew up landlocked in Moneygall, a tiny village on the Tipperary-Offaly border. Trips to the beach in my childhood were rare, maybe on the one day of July when the sun was splitting the stones, and my parents, both primary teachers, would take us three kids from the Midlands to Lahinch or Cortown or Clonay. The sea was a foreign place, an entity I found frightening and strange, and only came to love when I spent a few years in my 20s working in Dunleary. My first novel, Holding Her Breath, is obsessed with the sea in many respects, with protagonist Beth alternating between looking at it and fearing it before, spoiler alert, finally diving in on the final page. Despite this, Seamus and I have both become fascinated with islands and have visited many of Ireland's offshore islands together in the last few years. Clare Island, Cape Clear, both Inishbofins, but the one he wanted to visit more than any other was the Great Blasket. "I've looked out at it from Dunquin many times," he said, "but never visited. It looks so close to the shore, and yet it's so isolated." Seamus has read much of the rich literary output of the Blaskets, all of which have animated his vision of the island. Tomás O'Crohan's On Tolánach, Muirris O'Sullivan's Fiche Bliainic Fós, the monumental Peg. He still remembers the day in 1953 that the last 22 inhabitants were evacuated off the island, the front page of the newspaper held up in the classroom. I imagine Peg depicted in pointless black and white on the front page of the Irish Press. He and Burr, my mother, met on the Dingle Peninsula in 1968 when they were both student teachers down in the Gaeltacht Moria, and the area is meaningful for both of them. At age 74, they're both still in good nick, but Burr is content to view the Blaskets from the shore. The day we nominate to go, in late April, dawns bright and sunny and stays that way. We board the Peg Sayers, a bright orange speedboat in Dingle Harbour, and take to the open water at an impressive clip. It's warm enough that I can sit out on the stern and soak up the sun. I befriend Wolfie, the boat's resident dog, resplendent in his life jacket. He travels this route several days a week, so is mostly unfazed, but he still becomes animated when the boat encounters a pod of bottlenose dolphins, planting his paws on the side of the boat and barking. Billy, the skipper, tells us that Wolfie always gets this way. "We don't think he can see them or smell them," he says, "but he can hear them." We climb into a dinghy for the last 100 metres or so of the journey to navigate into what we later find out is called Partanuignus, the port from which islanders would emigrate to America or be taken to the mainland to be buried. The island is rugged and teeming with nature. The members of the seal colony, which we are told numbers 1500, lounge on the beach like contented cats. Every so often, they find the energy to flop out into the surf to go fishing. Brown, lanky hares congregate in groups of two or three before scattering, startled. Overhead, gannets dive bomb for their lunch. Vincent, our OPW guide, is a source of fascinating lore. The islanders, he tells us, grew accustomed to walking in single file on the island's narrow pathways, to the extent that they continued this practice on the mainland, making them instantly identifiable as island folk, even on the streets of Dingle. He tells us about the soup school, where the Protestant Mrs. Thompson taught and fed and attempted to convert kids during the famine years. Despite her proselytising ways, she still taught them through Irish. We hear that no one died of hunger on the island during the famine, salted mackerel sustaining the populace. We learn that the islanders thought of lobsters as demons and used to cast them out of their nets, until a visiting Frenchman showed them the error of their ways. We hear about Eileen McNichol, a feminist and gifted languages student from Dublin, who died in 1912 while teaching a girl to swim on the island's beach. The girl, Cóch, was saved, but Eileen and Cóch's brother Donal, who came to their aid, were both lost. We don't speak much on the boat trip home, partly because the sea is much rougher this time, partly because we're still processing what we've seen, heard and felt on the island. Midlanders overwhelmed by salt air. Later in Foxy John's with Burr, my father becomes reflective, as he is wont to do, over a pint. I don't know if any of my four grandparents ever moved more than 30 miles outside of Moneygall, he says. In many respects, we were all islanders.
Every word in a poem, says Boris Pasternak, must carry the ghosts of its own past. We inherit language. It comes down to us like a river. And the poet's business is to keep the water clear, to speak of the present moment in the present moment, using words that have come down to us from the ancestors. The past, if we are alive to it, is always an element in the living present. For a long time, we in Ireland did not fully understand that the built environment, the fabric of roads, homes and public buildings, was also a living inheritance, a gift from the past that could come alive in the present, could be put to new uses. Government Minister Kevin Boland was prepared to see Dublin's Georgian buildings destroyed wholesale on the grounds that they stood for, somehow embodied, the departed colonial power. Following successful resistance, many of these fine buildings were saved from the wrecking ball. Then came a tendency to prettify facades while gutting the insides, to concentrate on outward appearance, our very own take on the Potemkin villages. Now, however, many of those buildings are taking on a renewed lease of life, guided by dedicated conservation architects, animated by the lively imaginations of architects focused on present and future use of these inherited treasures. They call it repurposing, and it's worth dwelling on that word. Everything we construct is built for an original purpose, as a family home, a train station, a hospital, a business premises. And as form follows function, so a building's first life is to fulfill a purpose. But that's not the end of it. Times change, and to the eye of the imagination, a power station can become an art gallery, a family home can become a living museum. Repurposing involves taking stock of the physical building and asking, what new purpose might this serve? In the best instances, this process involves asking, what have we inherited here? How do we honour the original purpose? How do we honour what has come down to us while addressing the needs of the present and the future? Another way of putting this, how do we honour the ghosts of the past while providing for the living of the present moment? When we inherit a building, we also inherit the lives of all those who have lived and worked under that roof, between those walls. We remember them, and if we are wise, we honour their memory. We weave their lives into the living moment. We learn to think not just of those from whom we have inherited, but of those who will, in turn, inherit from us. As it happens, I have a perfect example of this process at work. Poetry Ireland, Aoife Éireann, is the organisation charged with serving and assisting poets and the art of poetry on the island of Ireland. In partnership with the Irish Heritage Trust, they have just begun work on developing 11 Parnell Square in Dublin as a home for Irish poetry. The building has all the impressive features we associate with the Georgian period: great public spaces, high ceilings, a sense of spaciousness and welcome. But it also allows for creative and respectful innovation. In a word, repurposing. As far as the fabric of the building is concerned, it's fortunate indeed that the architects for the rebuilding are McCullough Mulvan. The late Niall McCullough was a noted and highly respected historian of Dublin architecture, and the practice has a considerable reputation when it comes to innovating in the development of old buildings. There's more to the story, however, than the repurposing of a building. Áras Éagsearán, Poetry Ireland House, will also serve for the harnessing of ghosts and their purposes. Built by Luke Gardner, from 1770 to 1830, this was the Dublin home of the Butler family, Earls of Ormond. In 1887, it became the National Club, founded with aid from the Irish Republican Brotherhood. The inaugural dinner was attended by Michael Davitt and presided over by the old Fenian John O'Leary. The Dublin Parnell Leadership Committee was based at the club in the 1890s. Parnell himself addressed crowds from the balcony of the National Club on a number of occasions. In June 1897, the National Club was the focal point for a show of defiance against the official celebrations of Queen Victoria's Jubilee. On that occasion, a series of lantern slides were projected from the window of the club, outdoors across the square, showing the real Ireland of hardship and evictions. From here, a coffin to symbolise the sufferings of Ireland was carried to the Liffey by a great crowd, including James Connolly and Maud Gonne, and flung into the river. So much history in one building, so many men and women who, in their different ways, were dedicated to the betterment of life in Ireland. So many ghosts to be channeled and recruited to new purposes. So much brick, mortar, stone and slate into which new life is to be injected. This is to be a building for the whole of Ireland, embodying and celebrating a diversity of traditions, providing for the new and the unexpected, the repurposing of who we are and who we want to be. And so the river of inheritance rolls on, carrying us with it into what we must make of the living present, the future we must make together.
A country boy long exiled in Dublin and away from life working the land. I was recently back at the wheel of a tractor for the first time in a long time. It belonged to my brother John and was a John Deere 6110M high. A class of tractor so removed from the Massey Ferguson's 135 and 185 of my 1980s Leitrim childhood that it's hard to believe they belonged to the same species. I can imagine the John Deere sitting the little Massey 135 up on its knee, bouncing it about in an avuncular way before telling it to scoot along, that it's time for the men to get back to work. Yet for all the vast differences between this cosmopolitan animal and its rustic country cousin, it was one similarity that struck me. There, in John Deere's gearbox of 1,000 options, sat the equivalent of the humble low first. For those uninitiated in the ways of the Irish iron horse, low first is, as the name suggests, the lowest gear you can engage. But low first is as much a meditative state as it is a mechanical one. Entering it allows you to slow down to a pace rarely appreciated in modern life. It is the pace at which a fern's frond unfurls. It is the rate at which we age in our minds. It is a week away from your new lover. It is the speed at which trees grow. It is the time it takes your three-year-old to walk to creche when you're already late for work. I've never clocked a tractor in low first. The speedometers and hours were always broken. But I have a hunch that were any Garda to try, the speed camera would hand in its notice that evening retire to the country, and while away the rest of its days clocking snails in the garden. I love the name, Low First. It's got a John McGahern lack of pretension to it. The first reminds you of the natural order of things. Then the low brings you down to earth, wants you to stick your nose in the earth and smell what is called petrichor. Believed in Greek mythology to emanate from the spilt blood of the gods, petrichor is an earthy scent released when rain falls on dry soil. It causes a chemical reaction that allows the soil to release its essential oils, gifts alchemized from the deposits of flowers and plants, animals and insects, bacteria and minerals. Slow-falling rain releases more, hence the greater aroma following a light skift of rain, what is essentially the low first of precipitation. I most associate low first with another of nature's finest perfumes, the smell of fresh hay. You often deployed low gears when first introduced to tractor work on the farm, and when it was still hip to save square bales, one of your entry point duties was to slow slalom around these hexahedrons of hay, allowing those stouter of body to build the bales on the trailer as you passed by like an easy Sunday. The significance of this promotion for a young country boy cannot be underestimated. It is the equivalent of the Maasai initiation into the warrior class. Okay, maybe it's a little closer to the bull-jumping ceremony of the Harmer tribe in Ethiopia, but that's beside the point. No longer are you rolling bales out of the way like a dung beetle. You are sitting on the tractor throne, surveying your kingdom as it passes by, very, very slowly. Your young subjects look up to you, hoping that one day they too will make that leap from bipedal propulsion to quadrupedal locomotion, while you try to appease the elders by making sure you ease off the clutch gently and don't topple the castle of bales being constructed on the trailer behind you. Inevitably, after a short while, low first feels restrictive to the young mind. It looks to the west and swears a new mountain has grown in the time it last took to cross the field. Low first just isn't cutting the hay anymore. The mind races. It starts to think of all it could be doing in high fourth. It doesn't know that the young samurai first trains with a wooden sword. As with the beginning of any mindful process, to the unpracticed, slow can feel foreign. To sit with oneself and observe one's thoughts can be uncomfortable, discombobulating even. But like the stretch in the spring evening, it can add time to the day without stopping the clock. This is the way of low first. Wax on, wax off. The French mathematician, physicist, philosopher, and all-round sharp tool, Blaise Pascal, reckoned that all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. It's possible, just possible, that all farm boys' problems would drift away if they could just sit contentedly in low first.
Mowing, lifting, sowing, baling, drawing, hauling, number breaking, backing, stacking, plowing, crashing, tipping, wrapping, dealers flapping, sucking, diesel, cutting, trucking, spreading, piping, double, clutching, spinning, sliding, digging, rigging, rearing, tearing, losing, wind. Oh, hit the dip and pray that she goes all the way. When I'm flat to the mat with party hats, I'm heading for the sea.
The word heritage is derived from inheritance, but there are important differences between heritage, as we are talking about it during National Heritage Week, and inheritance. The foremost of these is that heritage is collective rather than individual. There's a key distinction between inheriting a house, for instance, and the access that everyone in Cove has to how St. Colman's Cathedral towers over the town. Or those who work in or visit the heart of Dublin share in the variegated landscaping of St. Stephen's Green. While such collective heritage is often presumed to be tied to ethnicity and ancestry, what the Heritage Council is charged with safeguarding is shared by all who live here, and through our hospitality, made available as well to our visitors. Heritage should not, however, be reduced to a commodity marketed to tourists. One of the glories of Dublin is that there is no charge to walk into the National Museum of Archaeology on Kildare Street and gasp at the tiny oars of the golden boat from the Breuter Hoard, or the intricate interlace of the Tara brooch. This does not preclude our ideas of heritage from having complex associations. For much of the 20th century, many in Ireland struggled to understand how buildings paid for by the Protestant ascendancy in the 18th century could be considered as being as Irish as passage tombs and round towers. Yet regardless of why they were built or for whom, Collins Barracks and Castletown House are part of our heritage, not simply because they're here, but also because large numbers of Irish people, many of them highly skilled, labored to construct and maintain these places. Many Irish people lived in them, from landowners to kitchen maids. But a dynamic culture also attracts talent, and Castletown is just one of the grand Irish houses that is graced with ornate decoration by stuccadors from the Ticino region of Switzerland, long before Irish artisans would help to construct cities and railroads all across Britain and the United States, not to mention Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Nor does heritage in Ireland need to have entirely Irish origins. Even the Tara brooch in the Book of Kells display their creator's awareness of artistic trends from as far away as the Byzantine Empire at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. For my own part, at the ceremony at which I became an Irish citizen, I was encouraged to retain and share my original culture. Although, as I come from the United States, this was not enormously challenging, I well remember how, only months after arriving in Ireland from California, I was surprised and delighted to see redwood trees on the grounds of Emo Court in County Leash. This spring, a large group of alumni from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., gathered in Dublin, where many of them, like Barack Obama before them, were delighted to explore the history of the visit the African-American abolitionist Frederick Douglass made to Ireland in 1845. Heritage can also be intangible, meaning that it doesn't need to consist of a physical object that can be passed down across the generations. Irish heritage thus encompasses the literature, music, dance, and even styles of these that have originated on this island. Here it is even more obvious that, copyright law aside, sharing is the essence of heritage. I first heard Yeats's poem, Down by the Sally Gardens, as sung in a recording and then performed live by the English-born minstrel Richard Dyer Bennett in my hometown in Maryland on the other side of the Atlantic. Sinead O'Connor's sad demise made it clear how many people around the world had drawn sustenance from the haunting beauty of her voice. This hints that, even though Yeats and O'Connor's talents sprang out of the traditions and circumstances of this island, they speak to experiences such as the waning of a love affair that are universal. Heritage Week encourages us to remember all of this, as well as to go out and explore something around us that we may never have visited before, or which we want simply to celebrate or possibly to learn about in more detail. Along the way, we become more connected, not just to this place, but also to each other.
Page torn from a diary. Morning, 23rd of June, St. John's Eve. It is a Sunday morning and I'm sitting in the back garden, with a cup of tea in my hand and wandering thoughts in my mind. A small twitching fire, encircled by grey stones, that stand like little sentinels, about the newly made hearth, burns about a foot from my boots. The flames, they are uncurling, whirling, weaving in and out among the twigs and snapped branches gathered from my walks. You may know that since my childhood, I've been utterly fascinated by campfires. Not just the campfires of lumber and uncurling smoke that invites the gathering of kind and kindred, that invoke outstretched hands to the warmth of the embers and the pirouetting flames of the pit, but the campfires of our lives, those places of secret warmth where we gather, share and connect. The places, often unseen, where traditional tales are passed on, those moments that can pass again and again through the ages, like little raindrops coming from the cloud to the ground, to the river, to the sea, to the sky, to being little raindrops all over again in the rain that touches us all. I am thinking about that little table, the one leg that wiggles by the weathered yellow window of Maggie's trailer, the short squat wall at the end of the road where the little Gocklands were gathered to talk, the bench in the park and the chair in the living room of my mother's home, and all those other places that sustain, embrace, give breath and soft wind to rise to. What happens though, I'm reasoning to myself on this fine morning, when a major aspect of heritage and culture, those vital sparks that illuminate the ever-unwinding path from the ancestors to the very soil beneath our feet, is opposed, denigrated, dismissed, ridiculed, or reduced. So those lines of being, those cords of connection, those ways of seeing and being the world, so highly regulated by the title society has given, that of traveller, seems so disconnected from the reality of life. To travel, to move, to enact the ancient ways of the nomad, when boulders on verge land stand as constant markers to deny passage. What happens when the shared garments of shelter and care are snagged and unravelled by the edges of popular discourse, or politicised policies, or the sharp cutting eyes of distant neighbours? I don't always mourn the things that I have lost, as I may not even know that I have lost them, or else they were never meant for me. I might as well miss the last Monday before the late Tuesday on which I was born on. It was never mine, even though with the due date, it could and should have been. Like faded photographs in shades of grey, with ruffled edges and torn borders, that catch moments in time, precious and worthy, but beyond the snap of the lens, things are always and forever changing. The fire in the garden, it spits at me. As the twig falls and I take handfuls of bark and dried leaves, I stock it up and I say to myself, what else do fires do? Ah, places of food and feeding. And I do not feel starved for culture, as I have grown up in and exist in the bounty of it. I do, however, I think while tossing a few more twigs onto the fire, have the curiosity for more, to stock the reserves, to share the warmth of it. Embers of heritage are tricky though, too tight a hold and we smother the fire, or it burns us with its intensity, too loose a grasp and it blows away by the casual winds. Instead I gamble, attention, reflection, reconnection. Most of all I feed the fire with the curiosity of the world around me. A Mona Curla Shul, a Lesko Curry, a Steedy Arak, a Gralti Amula, Ni Lugal Air Mashlo, Ar Thadir Akadi, Agree, agree, agree. The names of the flowers, and the story of the horses, and the healing by the waves, and the making of the crafts, not as a lament of the lost, but the strength of that which remains and continues to grow and grow and grow. I hope we can all make our campfires when and where we can, that we signal out their existence, the warmth they bring, the wisdom they carry, the protection they hold, and the sheer joy which they can provide. May we each keep our campfires, and may they burn bright.
Where will we crush today? We'll crush to Port Marnock Beach, where the air is clear and all I can hear is the pounding of her feet.
In the National Gallery, rambling around with my 7-year-old nephew. He is drawn mostly to images of animals, of children, of angels, much as I was drawn myself to images of animals, of children, of angels at his age. The statues were all about the horses and not the riders. In Merrion Square, I ask my nephew, what did he like best in the gallery? The see-through box with the money in it. The see-through box with the money in it. And yes, we were arrested by it. A transparent cube, the height of himself, half filled with paper money of divers countries, coins of many denominations, some 50s in a sea of fivers, a spattering of sterling and dollars, of zlotys and dimes. A fundraising ask at the exit, a stylish ask in a museum culture that is still predominantly free, pure gift, a respite from the loneliness of the city. And there are some miserable, gnarly-hearted old windbags who contest the free access to museums and the national collections. For so many, for so long, these buildings have been places of sanctuary. The museums and galleries and libraries, sanctuary. They were sanctuary in a big way when disaffected and miserable as a teenager and always in trouble. I could at least ramble in and lose myself in the random space that opens randomly when one surrenders to the museum angel, a close kin to the library angel, the eye falling on the exact right image, the hand falling on the exact right book at the exact right time. Heritage, story across time, in hearing, in matter. Go back to the very earliest meaning of the word and we get the root to be empty, left behind. Source also of the Greek word for widow. A sudden access to the dizzying aeons of loss. The dead stirring in their stuff. So much stuff left behind. The human mark upon the face of the earth. I was commissioned some years ago to write poetry for the opening of the Dublin Tenement Museum, number 14 Henrietta Street. Originally built for Lord Molesworth and his family, though at the time of the 1911 census, it was home for 100 souls. My roots were in the ageing, hulking remnants of the Second City of Empire and the dereliction and abandonment that I saw of built heritage and people. One man's dereliction is another woman's biodiversity, and I had got fond of Luke Gardner's mouldering ruins with their Budleia forests and gardens gone wild as the abandoned communities themselves. I had the heritage of the lens of Monto, the biggest red light district at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, where so many dramas of the revolution and the rise of the Roman Church were played out. If we are enshrining battlegrounds, let us enshrine the ground of being where women's bodies were the battleground in brothel and convent alike. The lens, like a magic mirror, has determined how I live the other side of the looking glass, what my projections and reflections will be. When I went to look at those roots, I found myself in a chasm or an abyss or sometimes a sunlit valley between the written record and the folklore, between what had survived in the archives and what the folk memory of the area itself had preserved like a bee's wing in amber. Who was speaking truth to power back in the day, back in the Monto? For the Henrietta Street Commission, I needed a way to organise and perhaps even make safe the material I would draw on. Language itself is a museum. I knew the word museum comes to us from the Greek, a place to put things, to please the muses. And who are the muses but the daughters of memory? I had studied the Georgian fascination with the classical world, lyres and panpipes, all the panoply of the creatures of myth in the stuccadore's ornamentation. And I could ascribe certain areas of the tenement heritage to the protection of the different muses, the nine daughters of memory. I wrote a sonnet for each of the muses. I wanted the taste of the danger that the sonnet form represents, the karma of the form, its historical accretions. It was pulled into English by the soldier poets of Elizabeth I. I feel in my epigenetic core the ethnic cleansing of Munster, the home of the McCarthys, my mother's people. Planting Munster for the crown, the soldier poets' heritage. The project culminated in a beautiful book called Museum, designed by Una Young. I was blessed to integrate the poems with the sublime photography of Dragana Jurisitz. I'll read one poem from that sequence. Our Lady of the Apocalypse is dedicated to Polyhymnia, muse of sacred poetry. It references a tender memory I have of cold winter mornings before I headed out to school. Some of the tenements were open-doored. Some had closed doors. Our door never closed. My mother, my beautiful fiery mother, would give me a cut of toast and a cup of tea to take out to the rough sleepers who had come in at night for shelter. They were strange mysteries to the child I was. Our Lady of the Apocalypse. Our Lady of the Apocalypse, who never closed your heart to the dissolute, pray for us who found shelter in broken down Georgian tenements, who kept the doors open to the demented ones, who came in rags and miasmas of foul odour, in delirium tremens, the worn out old spunkers, the displaced relicts of imperial trauma. O sweet daughter of memory, veiled in enigma, who brought longed-for oblivion to the Mets drinkers, the Dipsos, the Alcos, the put-down-no-hopers, who came in from chaos, from cold, from winds, from rains, to sleep it all off in hallways, in stairwells, who rent the long night with sobs, who cried out to you in the throes of their last agony, grant them eternal succour.
That was a special Sunday Miscellany to mark National Heritage Week with the support of the Heritage Council. It was first broadcast last year. The writing was Islanders by Emer Ryan. Heritage Now was by Theo Dorgan. And then Low First by Colin Regan. Our Shared Inheritance was by Kathleen James Chakraborty. A Page Torn from a Diary, Campfires, was by Owen de Vardoon. And lastly, Our Lady of the Apocalypse was by Paula Meehan. The music was Ilona Teshkina by Lasarina Nikanila. Introduction, The River Holds Its Breath by Cullum Oconomara. Hit the Diff by Marty Moan. I'll Be Singing was by Sinead O'Connor. And Feeling Free by Sharon Ward. National Heritage Week is currently underway and runs until next weekend with events all over the country. To find out what's on in your local area, take a look at heritageweek.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can find out more about the programme on our website rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany, and you can also listen back on the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.